see you all.
Thank you.
I guess normally we'd work the room a little more, but sorry about that. Eddie, nice to see you. George, good to see you again. Professor, how are you, sir? Thank you. I guess I start this show.
I think you're starting, and then we will start our discussion, which I'm very much looking forward to, and I appreciate you all for doing the work that you do, for your expertise, and for the discussion we're about to have. I hope to be able to get in depth about some of the issues that you all are addressing, but also to hopefully help the American people understand what's possible on the issue of public transit and to uphold some of the great work that you are doing, which I think is a great model for the country.
So thank you. And there is a reason that the vice president chose to come to Cincinnati. One, it's one of America's great cities. Second, what this city has done on transit, especially to come here. And Daryl and I have had these conversations. Daryl testified one of the first hearings I had as the new chair of the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. That committee has just generally been referred to as Senate Banking, but it was too much about Wall Street. Now it's about transportation. It's about housing. It's about civil rights. It's about the issues that I know everybody around this table cares about. And thank you for the chamber's involvement in transit, unlike in many ways more than any chamber in the country. So thank you for doing that. The chamber's business, the chamber's support for the advance in transit in this country was in this community was essential. Earlier this month, as I said, when Daryl testified at our transit hearing, I closed the hearing by asking him the last question, what transit means for people's lives. And his answer was just perfect in terms of how some people can't get home from work if they work late, if they don't have bus service, and many cities don't. Cincinnati now does it right, and it's because you all came together. So my pleasure to introduce Vice President Harris. She came here, she and I were here together in 2017. She then spoke at our annual women's conference in Columbus. She was so good and so well received. We were going to have her back the next year in Cincinnati, and then we were both called to session and didn't get to do that. But she has made such a difference as vice president already. I want to tell one story before turning it over to her. We were talking one day about we had just returned to session in early February, late January, and we were sitting on the Senate floor, and we were talking about our Dr. King celebrations that she had been to in California and I had been to in Ohio. And we were talking about Dr. King's term that he used often, dignity of work. And she somehow, 3 days later, the next week on the floor, came up and handed me a book called All Work Has Dignity. It was a compilation of Dr. King's speeches to labor unions. And you all know Dr. King was killed fighting for workers, some of the most discriminated against workers in the country, sanitation workers in Memphis. And if I didn't already love Kamala Harris, I did after that discussion, just that what we were talking about, dignity of work. And Dr. King always said, all labor has dignity. No job is menial if it pays an adequate wage. And that's so much of what she's fought for in her career and what has so mattered to her and so mattered to the people whom she serves. So, Senator Harris, Vice President Harris, good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Chairman Brown. My friend Sherrod, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for everything that you do. I have traveled this beautiful state many times, actually, with your senator. And whether the cameras are on or off, he is the same person. He is always fighting, in particular, for the working people of Ohio, but for America. And you are a great national leader, Sherrod, Chairman Brown. So thank you for this. And thank you all for the time. So I look forward to getting into this conversation. But, you know, I'll put it in the context of also, again, back to the chairman. He chairs a committee in the United States Senate that is named Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. And I remember talking with the senator when he first took the chairmanship, and he said, you know, people always refer to it as the Banking Committee. But the housing and urban affairs part of that committee is equally impactful, if not more, in terms of the direct impact on working people. That's who the chairman is. And so when I think about the work that happens out of the United States Congress, the work we can do as an administration, I do think of it through the lens that he has talked about it, which is how are we going to have direct impact on working people? How are we going to improve the condition of their lives? How are we going to make it doable? Because sadly, that's at some point the goal, much less easy. But let's just start with making it doable. Can they raise their families, get to work, get to the grocery store, satisfy their basic responsibilities and functions to raise a family and to be productive in their community and in their lives? And so that's the context in which I think about this very important subject, which is the subject of public transit. And, you know, when I think about it, I think about good transit equals vibrant communities, right? So if we think about it in terms of an investment in public transit, it is an investment in job creation. It is an investment in improving communities. It is an investment in increasing access to opportunity. Literally, if there is a bus line that is within and a bus stop that is within walking distance and not half a mile from someone's house, what that means in terms of their ability to have access to the job that may be miles away from where they live. And often it is the case for working people in America that they cannot afford to work where they live, and they need to then travel some distance. And it shouldn't require that you have the financial ability to own a car, pay insurance, pay for new tires, to be able to go to work. So I think about public transit in that context. I think about it in the context of what it means for a working parent to be able to take her children, to take his children to school, and not have to walk long distances or figure out some other way to get a ride from somebody to take one's child to school, especially the youngest of our children. I think of it in the context of the fact that in so many communities, sadly, we are still at a place where we talk about food deserts, where we talk about the unavailability of grocery stores that sell fresh food, much less fruits and vegetables. And people have to travel distances. Well, our public transit allows that to happen. It is that basic and that essential. And then let's think of it in the context of what the pandemic did. And in the midst of extraordinary loss, we also saw the pandemic as an accelerator in that it highlighted and for so many people illuminated longstanding fissures and failures in our systems. And it highlighted the importance on this point of the importance of public transit, where so many of our first responders, our healthcare workers, our home care workers, relied on public transit to get to work every day, to continue doing the work, which was about saving lives, often the lives of people who were perfect strangers to them. I think about it in the context, and the president talks about this. He talked about it a couple of days ago at the meeting of the joint session of Congress, about good jobs. And the jobs are about the jobs that will include growing the infrastructure around public transit. The good jobs are the jobs about all of the folks who work to make public transit work, including a wonderful leader that we talked to before we walked in here. It's about what we're going to do in the American Jobs Plan, $110 billion, that's with a B, for transit agencies, $85 billion to modernize and expand transit, and $25 billion to electrify transit buses, something that we talked about here, Mr. Haley. And then there is the last point that I'll make about transit being good for public health and the climate, because that means a lot of folks can get on a bus, and those folks then are not driving, and we are reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we are reducing emissions that are harmful to our climate. It is about what you're doing here in Cincinnati, and it's happening around our country, and the American Jobs Plan will help grow that exponentially, which is also the creation of electric vehicles and electric transit, public transit. Mm-hmm. So there is so much good work happening here and happening around our country as an extension, and let's continue to invest in public transit in America, understanding that it's about supporting working families, it's about supporting our infrastructure, our economy, and our public health. So with that, I will turn the mic back to the chairman so we can begin our discussion.
Thank you, Madam Vice President. Let me introduce each of the, she chose to come to Cincinnati. I chose the five of you to sit and talk with her about transit. And when you come to talk infrastructure in Cincinnati, you talk from transit to the Brent Spence Bridge.
Yes.
But today it's mostly about transit. So Daryl Haley, whom you've already met, mm-hmm. CEO of Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, has been innovative working with the business community and all of us. Eddie Cohn is head of the Cincinnati Urban League, relatively new CEO here, great service to this community already. Troy Miller is head of the Transit Union. His workers sort of are the definition of essential workers, people who expose themselves to this virus every single day, and they have stood strong and continue to serve this community. Professor Mehta teaches urban issues at this great university, University of Cincinnati. Thank you for the way you weigh in. Jill Meyer, longtime friend of mine, who's head of the Cincinnati Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber really stepped up to make this, to help modernize this transit system because they understand all this. So I will just begin to ask each of you a question, and the Vice President obviously can weigh in with comments or further questions, and we'll just do that that way. Daryl, at the end, I was talking in the end of our hearing the other day, I said, run through the life of what it means to a worker to have a just somebody that uses the bus, what it means to their lives to have a really functioning high-tech transit system like you have built.
So when we were talking about that, the example I gave was that there was a woman that one of our riders that we talked to, that she worked at a job on a Sunday, and our service is really low on Sunday, so she couldn't take public transportation to get to and from her job on Sunday. So what she would have to do on Sunday is she'd have to take an Uber to get to and from work, and it was just on Sunday, but she couldn't keep her job if she couldn't get there on Sunday. So she would take her entire pay for that day on Sunday to pay Uber to get to and from her job so that she could keep her job the other days of the week. So public transit is about connection. And it's not just about connection to jobs, although our Reinventing Metro plan will connect to more than 20,000 additional jobs, but it's also about connecting to higher paying jobs.
Yeah.
And by connecting to higher paying jobs, the effect that it'll have on poverty, the effect that it'll have on crime, all of those things. So by moving more out into the community, having more frequent service. So my bus isn't coming once an hour. Mm-hmm. It's coming every 15 or 20 minutes. I don't have to come all the way into downtown Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. I can come partway and then transfer and move. And then creating these very safe places. We talked about our new transit center.
Yeah.
These real nice, safe places with innovative ideas, charging ports for cars and whatnot for people to catch their buses, mm-hmm. to help move very quickly through our system. So those are the things that are really important.
Thank you, Daryl.
And you've highlighted something that, again, just these subjects can take on big meaning, and we use these subjects in big speeches. But let's get back to the point you're making about how it affects real people every day. Without having a high frequency of public transit buses, then that means that working person, if they're just 30 seconds late to catch that bus, if they have to wait an hour for the next bus to come,
right.
what that will mean in terms of whether they may be able to keep their job or not, it's critical.
Yeah.
And so that's about having the frequency. It's about making sure that the bus stops are in the communities where people live and need to go to work. I think that's a critical point. I know you're also doing some work here that's about, you showed me about GPS and adapting technology so that folks can be aware of where the bus is.
At all times.
At all times, to know if they need to hurry up mm-hmm. or they can slow down to catch the bus they need to get where they need to go on time.
And you touched on one other thing earlier you were talking is the people, a person's choice
yes.
of what they choose to do. So I may choose not to have a car payment. I may choose not to have a car insurance and gas and wear and tear on my car. And then I can take those earnings that I would have been spending on that, and I can do something else in my life with it. I can upgrade my the place that I live.
Yeah.
I may be able to make different choices because I have additional funding mm-hmm. that I could use other places than in an automobile. So it's about choice as well, and people can make different choices when you have robust transit in your community.
That's a great point.
Good. Jill, if you would, Jill, talk about it's the way you stepped up in the business community. Why so much interest in the ballot initiative? Why so much interest in the American Jobs Plan? What it will mean to this community?
Thank you, Senator Brown. I'm delighted to do that. Madam Vice President, we're obviously excited to have you here, but couldn't be more excited to be able to talk about this topic. Mm-hmm. It has been one of intense focus for us at the Chamber and really throughout the community over the past 5+ years. What we know is what we're talking about. When people can make choices, we know that they can access better jobs. And when they access those jobs, you have growing businesses, thriving communities, all as a result of people being able to reach a means to that livelihood. And a small story, when I started at the Chamber about 5.5 years ago, I was having conversations with CEO after CEO who they all had a talent challenge. And that's very common to hear, but as we dug just a little bit deeper, what we said to many of them was, you don't actually have a talent problem, you have a transportation problem.
Right.
And that is what really put it on our radar, that throughout our entire region, we have such a wonderful diversity of industry and mm-hmm. companies and opportunities, but our aged and underfunded infrastructure has not allowed
right.
our businesses to get their employees to their front doors. Mm-hmm. We know that a dollar spent on transit equates and becomes about $3 in economic impact otherwise. We also know, and you alluded to this, Madam Vice President, that where transit is accessible is where development happens. People live there, businesses can open there and operate there, mm-hmm. and the data across the country shows that cities who invest in transit have faster growing economies, but even within those cities, the places where transit is accessible within a quarter mile, the economic development booms.
Quarter mile of where people live?
A quarter mile of transit access
uh-huh.
is where most of that development happens, even within those cities.
Uh-huh.
And so it's vitally important to understand your point. If you can walk to mm-hmm. access, mm-hmm. you now open yourself to an ability to travel, to a lot more right. opportunity.
Right.
The Chamber did make this our top priority. And the reason is because a growing economy needs transit access. We need people to move around. I would add that one of the partners, everybody around this table partnered in the effort to help Issue 7 get passed. One of our partners, Mayor John Cranley, the city of Cincinnati, he understood that transit and infrastructure are hand in hand, and you can't improve one unless you're improving the other. And that is something that we have spent a fair amount of time focused on. And it begs for me to talk about where we're sitting right now and how this plays in. So here we are at the intersection of a busy, growing economic corner that is symbolic of so much for our community right now. The interchange, the MLK interchange opened about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in that 4 years, I was dreaming ahead of time, but in that 4 years, the amount of promise and planning for the future is just outweighs any other opportunity. The really important thing about it, though, is that it opens up Avondale. Mm. This is a historic community in Cincinnati that for decades there was disinvestment while sitting alongside world-class hospitals, mm-hmm. level one research universities, research labs, and this opportunity now to bring people to different jobs to get them from the community to mm-hmm. other locations as well is really a critical important point for people here, and I know these opportunities happen in cities across the country, that you're not only making up for past disinvestment, but you're building your future right on top of that, and the marriage of those two mm-hmm. pieces, when done thoughtfully, creates a tremendous economic upside for where we are headed going forward.
So has the Chamber done an analysis of how increased public transit supports small businesses, knowing that, of course, small businesses mm-hmm. nationally employ half of America's workers?
Yes. Yes. We've done and continue to do lots and lots of studies, both learning from other communities who did it faster than we did, mm-hmm. But also creating our own and figuring out what's happening here. Yes. The number of people we are blessed with some major corporations mm-hmm. here, of course, mm-hmm. but lots and lots of people work at those smaller and mid-sized companies. And they're all over the region. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a city like Cincinnati, which is an old city and it's a wonderful city, mm-hmm. but it is concentrated in the middle, lots of people right. live here. Mm-hmm. We also have job opportunities outside of those places. Mm-hmm. And so the neighborhood business districts in and around the Cincinnati city and extended do employ a lot of people. And yeah. so one of the pieces that we were so excited to do as we worked toward the ballot initiative was we mapped out the entire region, where the jobs were, mm-hmm. what kinds of job corridors there were, and then mm-hmm. we overlaid the existing plan and then the mm-hmm. hoped-for plan to make certain that the jobs that would become accessible included both big corporate outlying jobs as well as those business districts within
great.
To
That's
make
great.
Sure everybody has that opportunity.
That's great.
You said something, too, Jill, about, and I wanted to ask Eddie about this, about the locating transit stops as close to housing accessibility transit stops. And one of the things that Congresswoman Fudge, who now is Secretary of HUD, was my congresswoman in Cleveland, is now Secretary of HUD, that she is working with the Department of Transportation and the Biden-Harris administration to figure out how to encourage housing near transit stops. And that's where there is potential, obviously, for people not to be able not to have a car and be able to get to work. So, Eddie, how does that all play for people of color in this community, where particularly among low-wage workers, and what their access to transit has been and how these developments will matter for people getting to and from work and to and from family responsibilities and other things they're doing?
Thank you, Senator Brown. And thank you, Madam Vice President. It's an honor to be here today. You know, I will say that the issue of transportation is complicated when you think about communities of color. You know, on the one hand, it's wealth sharing. And on the other hand, we look at it as wealth extraction. When you think about highways, just maybe about 5 miles west of here, Kenyon Bar was a black community in 1960 where 25,000 residents were displaced for I-75. Now, on the other hand, you know, when you think about wealth sharing, issue 7, when I think about first and final mile, the work that Daryl has done, how we enhance our workforce and labor, I'll give you a quick story from one of the clients that we serve. We have a partnership with the University of Cincinnati to create more nurses to diversify their workforce. We have one client who lives two zones away from her child care. She's 21 years old with three kids. She has to get up at 5 a.m. right to drop her kids off two zones away, come back to the university to take classes. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, we have staff who helped her out and actually helped her babysit. So when you think about the real challenges of social mobility, of race and how transportation intersect, I think transportation is just as important as policing, as health disparities, for people who are ready to work and to be employed. And if we really want to think about a pathway to the middle class, we have to center people who are the end users. We have an incredible opportunity as leaders. I am thrilled at the leadership of President Biden and Madam Vice President Kamala Harris to weaponize the leadership that we have to really think about transit from a racial equity lens and make sure that we're centering those voices and those stories that my colleague shared earlier.
Thank you, Eddie. Troy, far too many of your workers face the dangers at work of exposure to this virus, especially over the last 13 months, and then the anxiety of coming home, knowing the potential that they potentially infect their families. Talk to me about the dignity of work and your transit workers and what they face every day and what you as the union are able to do for them.
So here in Cincinnati, we have roughly about 800 members total. 1/8 of our membership was positive in the last year. That's 1/8. You know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And we had some that spent time in the hospital in a long period of time. So we've had to deal with a lot. And with the leadership of the Biden-Harris administration, we were fortunate because you enforced masks at the beginning of the year. The previous administration didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And we dealt with that issue because people get on the buses coughing. And then in the circulation of the buses, there's nowhere to go. It's a bus. Mm-hmm. And it's right there in the ventilation. You just keep getting it. Mm-hmm. So it's been rough. It's been a challenge for our people over the last year. We did meet Daryl and myself. We sit down and worked on a lot of issues, scheduling, changing schedules, try to make it better for the employees. It's been a challenge. So it's been tough. And I will say the American Rescue Plan was great because, you know, $75 million came to Cincinnati, you know, because of this. So it's been a challenge here in Cincinnati. It's been, you know, going home with your families, dealing with it. It's been tough. And you're always worried what you're going to take home. And this is not just here. This is internationally, too.
Yeah.
We had 151 brothers and sisters across the United States pass away. Wow. So, and it's staggering, and I'll give you some numbers. Over 4,700 members were infected in the United States. Over 3,000 laid off, or currently still laid off, ATU members. And then at one time, we had 20,000 laid off, you know, in the United States. So it's devastating. This whole virus has been devastating for us. And with your leadership and President Biden's leadership, the both of you, it's been great. And now we see the American Jobs Plan coming, and it's making it exciting for us. Because now we're seeing, you know, those things that you guys are investing, because the infrastructure piece is huge. Not only did we just pass a tax levy for the first time since 1970 here in Cincinnati. That's the first tax levy we've passed in 1970, so we can grow the transit. Mm-hmm. And then now this American Jobs piece comes on top. Mm-hmm. Which one of the things we're really excited about, I was talking with our international, I found out, is some of the things you guys have worked on in this bill is the new green buses.
Yeah.
And actually putting language in there to train our mechanics. Mm-hmm. Because too many times I've seen people lose their jobs because they get farmed out because they don't want to give their training to the department or the place. So I'm happy to hear we got good union jobs, not being contracted. We're going to help you keep our jobs here, grow. This is exciting for us. So I'm excited to have, you know, the Biden-Harris administration working on all the things you have. And with the challenges we've dealt with the virus, and I know there's challenges still moving forward. We still, you know, deal with it, and we'll probably deal with it for a while. Now, in with this is we're excited we was able to help people ride the buses for free to go get their vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
So that was some good we did here in the city. And they did it actually in the state of Ohio.
Troy, talk about what the Vice President and I have talked about this before, that we want to, one of the goals of our, of this, of the jobs plan, the infrastructure plan, and in our long-term, but really medium-term efforts are to replace 60,000 diesel buses with 60,000 zero-emission buses. Understanding you have a whole lot of mechanics in Local 627 that are trained to work on diesel buses, diesel engines. Talk about that transition, and talk about what your members are saying about that, understanding that people aren't going to get laid off, but they're going to be retrained during this process over the next several years.
Yeah, so my background is actually maintenance. So this is exciting me because, you know, you can go get that training and keep that. I would love to see the ATU be one of the leaders in that training across the United States. I'd love to see that because this is very important. Protecting our people, you know, protecting our jobs. Because so many times I hear, you guys ain't qualified, we don't need you. And it's not just here, it's all over. And it is a very big importance to have that knowledge and training and keep the jobs here.
How many of your 800 workers, how many of your 800 members are mechanics?
Roughly about 200. We have 200 maintenance employees between all the divisions.
So you should know, you probably do, in the American Jobs Plan, we actually do have substantial money set aside for training. And knowing that organized labor usually has some of the best apprenticeship and training programs available and taking full advantage of that. But and in addition to that point, then, can you talk a little bit about what it has meant for your members to be part of a union while they have been going through these challenges and the sacrifices they have made? And by the way, please thank them on behalf of the President and me for the work they've been doing and the sacrifices they've made to do that work.
Well, we also thank you for being having our back to fight these issues, you know, and help us on these issues. It's been challenging because it's just you never know what you're going to get the virus or not. You know, you're dealing with it. We did sit down. We did change schedules, and we did change hours, and we spent a lot of time I joked around with Daryl one day. I said, on Saturday, I said, I didn't know I was going to be doing management work, writing schedules. And on Saturday, I wrote a schedule for maintenance. It's been a challenge to help our workers to get it done safely and make it right for everyone.
That's great. And if I'd like to come back to Eddie for a second. Can you talk a bit about what racial equity looks like in this conversation?
Sure.
And what are some of the best practices that you are advocating?
Sure. I think one is just ridership. The average worker takes about 3 hours when you think about getting to and from a job if they use public transportation. So that's two hours of opportunity cost loss. I think the analysis often when we think about public transportation is how much ridership do we have? What's the profitability of a stop? But something that is holistic around the cost of the environment, mm-hmm. The time, the opportunity cost back to those lower wage workers that maybe have to use transportation, I think is good. And then the place of where they are, whether it's 10 to 20 minutes to a stop, right? Yeah. Part of what's calculated is having to walk to another stop and transfer over. So mm-hmm. really looking at the grid of maps to say, where are their gaps? Where are the places that people can assess transportation to places where they can also have some economic opportunity?
I think that's such a critical point you've made, the opportunity cost. That mother or that father having to take 2 hours to go to work because they have to transfer somewhere because there's not a direct route or because there's not an express bus available, and what that means in terms of time lost with their children, sure. time lost doing homework, and just the fatigue that sets in addition to the work that work day.
Absolutely.
That's a really important point. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Vice President. Professor Mehta, you've looked at, probably more than anybody in the room, looked at sort of the big picture and what this does for a community. How does this, the work that all four of the panelists talked about, how does that transform this city's economy and this city's, more importantly, really, its quality of life?
Thank you, Chairman Brown, Madam Vice President. This is a great opportunity, and we really appreciate that you're bringing the discussion not about just transportation, but about transit. And I think that's really, really critical. So when we think about transit, we think about engineering, technology, logistics, the hard infrastructure. But there's another side to it, which is really the soft infrastructure of transit. And that goes to the point about livability. There is the element of all of the public space that's right outside our private properties to the transit. And that's really, really critical. What is the condition of those sidewalks? What is the condition of those crosswalks? Are those lit? Can a single mother with a stroller and a child in tow get to the transit stop safely? Mm-hmm. What about somebody who is vision impaired? These things are equally important. I just call it the soft infrastructure of transit to be able to make this thing work in which we invest billions of dollars. As an urbanist, for me, transit is not just technological. It is social, it is psychological, and experiential. And we need to think about the full total experience, both technologically and from a community perspective, from door to door. And from that door to door, one piece of it is the hardwired, hard infrastructure of transit, buses, trains, all of that. Mm-hmm. But the other part is really the soft infrastructure of communities, of the neighborhoods we live in. And we cannot separate these things. The best part about it is that if we invest in the soft infrastructure, we are automatically investing in our neighborhoods. We're automatically investing in a sense of thinking about this as a complete mobility strategy. Mm-hmm. So we often think about transit as a product. And transit is not a product. It is a system and it is an ecology, which means that transit is a piece of all the mobility about how do we get anything that, Madam Vice President, you talked about. How do we get to do anything, whether it's shopping, going to work, getting the child to a soccer game? All of that can be linked into our experience of transit and the urban sort of living. Mm-hmm. So integrating transit into the urban development is really, really key into our neighborhoods. that is different from just thinking about transit itself. This has also become very critical in this time of the pandemic, as you mentioned. Thinking about the public space immediately in our neighborhoods is a public health need. What is the condition of our sidewalks and streets? We need those to walk, to exercise, to socialize. But they're also part of the transit network.
Mm-hmm.
On another context, which is really, really critical to us in the U.S., and we really appreciate that you're bringing this to the table, we have to modernize our transit. We cannot think about transit as the service, something that we need to provide for the poorest workforce.
Mm-hmm.
That is one approach, but it's not going to get us to compete in this world. We have to think about transit that is a public good for everybody. It has to be cool. It has to be sexy. Everybody should want it. It shouldn't be about, well, we're serving the poor and the workforce that is outside of the cities to get to it and reduce the time. That is not going to be our strategy. And we really appreciate the ambitious plans that are coming from the Biden-Harris administration, and we need to capitalize on this. We need to really change our thinking about that and think about it really, really holistically. My final point, certainly public transit has a huge component and big ramifications for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to touch a different point. Public transit runs in public space, on our streets, above, below. Public transit, in fact, is public space.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about in today's polarizing society, we need to think about the value of that, the input of that into a place of dialogue. Now, this might seem extremely academic, but it's real. This is where you want to be able to see people who are different from you, people who mm-hmm. dress differently, who look different. But this is critical for a democratic society.
Mm.
And it's critical for a society that is empathetic.
Well said. Thank you, Professor, for that. Let me close with a question for Daryl. He closed our committee the other day, and so answer this if you would. And Professor Mehta made me think of this question as he was talking about reaching everyone. Somebody walks in this room and says, "You know, I don't care about SWORD. I never ride it. It doesn't matter to me. Why should I care about public transit in this city?" Well, what do you say? You know, people come up and ask you that, I'm sure. Why should I vote for this levy, Jill? Why should I care? Why should I bother even in this discussion? Why do I care that Biden and Harris is coming to town and Biden and Harris are passing this bill where a lot of money goes to public transit? Why do I care about that?
That is an extremely important question. I'm really glad you asked that. And again, I want to echo the other members here. Thank you, Madam President. Senator, for being here so much. This is really great conversation. So for even those who won't use public transport, who don't use public transportation, the people that they count on public transportation. So when you go to the doctor's office or the hospital or the grocery store or the shopping or the education, all of those people you come in contact with, they use public transportation to get there. So even if you yourself don't use public transportation, the people you count on public transportation to get them there.
Well said. You're nodding. You want to weigh in on that question too, Eddie?
I think the professor says something interesting about the, I like how you termed it, the soft infrastructure of transit. So I think about the whole ecology of creating a multimodal transportation system. And while it is important to always keep a racial equity lens, because we know if we do not, we do unintended harm, and this has been evidenced in different spheres outside of transportation. You know, I think about buses that have bikes in the front of them. Well, why don't we have places for strollers on most buses, mm-hmm. right? So we always have to. We have an opportunity now as we're thinking about reimagining transportation and things like. Thank you for the comment around getting to the bus stops. I think about the Gang of 19 who sat and protested in front of buses to have ADA accommodations, right? And this, what we have an opportunity to do today is to think about who are the majority of the users, who are the end users, mm-hmm. and include that. It's a both and, it's not an either or. So how do we expand transportation for people who may not traditionally are looked at as the end user, and for those who use it every day to rely to get to jobs, to look at it as a vehicle for social mobility?
So, Jill, how did you convince some businesses that thought, I don't want my taxes going up, I don't really care about transit, I don't use it, might be a high end, but maybe most of their employees don't. How did you convince them?
I was smiling as Daryl was answering the question of getting people to understand that their reality is not everyone's reality, but from a business perspective, businesses are not inanimate objects. They are humans who bring that business to life. And business leaders who looked very closely and realized that the more access, the more talent who could more easily reach their doors, the more thriving their business can be. But at the same time, what we know here in Cincinnati, I think better than anywhere in the country, businesses are a lifeblood for our economics, but they also provide the lifeblood for our communities. And I'm interested, or listening with interest, this conversation about who uses the buses. What we know, and data tells us more apparently every year, talent. There was a point in time when public transportation was built for people who couldn't afford cars. We have talent in this country now, the 24 to 44 set, they require mobility choices. They require transit access to make a choice about where they will live and where they will invest. And that is a changed reality, but it is a very loud and clear reality that if your business is going to grow, you have to be able to get a diverse workforce to your front door.
Well said. Madam Vice President, again, thank you for coming to the Queen City, to our great city, and to hear the wisdom, the collective wisdom of the five of them. Thank you, and why don't you close out? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, this has been a very insightful conversation, and I have taken copious notes. But I think that what this conversation has revealed are the many dimensions, and therefore the many people in the various capacities of their lives, how they are impacted by public transportation. And we can start with the workers. And the fact that they are essential workers, and by the way, should not be sacrificial workers. And that means understanding what they need in terms of being in the workplace in a safe environment and giving them the support that they deserve, as well as the chairman and I always talk about, recognizing the dignity of that work and the value of that work, and recognizing it in every way, including pay and benefits. It means understanding the significance of, and Mr. Cohen, you said it so well, we have to pay attention to racial equity, because to not is to neglect the reality of the need to pay attention to racial inequity based on longstanding inequities. But thinking of it in terms of also the opportunities, be it for Mr. Haley in terms of what you're doing with this transit authority or the Chamber of Commerce, and what this can do, an investment in public transit that is about job creation, building up the economy, building up productivity, building on the cultural institutions of a community, which always have an impact on the well-being and the quality of life of any community. Access to arts, access to sports, access to those things, and hopefully that are public spaces, Professor, that create a quality of life that every person should be entitled to receive. The points that you've made, Professor, about public spaces, I think, is so important. And I appreciate the point that you were making also about thinking of the realities of sidewalks, streetlights, as being part of the transit ecosystem. If that parent, if that mother or father can't walk that stroller because the sidewalks are uneven or falling apart, and she's got a child in a stroller and a toddler, well, that's going to mean that will take at least twice as much time for her to get up, get down, and hopefully have somebody help her with the stroller to get to the bus stop. Lights, and what that means in terms of the safety for both the workers and the folks who use the system. So I think this has been an incredible group to really highlight all of the facets and all of the relevancy of an investment in public transportation, which again, infrastructure, and the chairman and I have talked about this. Infrastructure, you know, it's a fancy word for just how do you get to where you need to go? That's really what it's about. How do you get to where you need to go? Hopefully without struggle and with some level of ease, because usually where people need to go is they need to go to work, their children need to go to school, they need to go to the grocery store, they need to go to the place where they worship, they need to go to a sports game from time to time. So I appreciate you all for this conversation and all the work you do, and I plan to highlight it, and of course the President thanks you for the work that you are doing. It's a great model for what our country will and can do. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you
very
again.
Much, Kamala. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. This is really enlightening.
Madam President, could you speak to the crisis in India right now and what lessons you take from that?
There is no question that it is a great tragedy what we're witnessing in terms of the loss of life. And as I have said before and I will say again, we as a country have made a commitment to the people of India to support them, and we've made already a commitment in terms of a dollar amount that will go to PPE and a number of other things. But it is tragic, and you know, my prayers go to the people and the suffering. That's the blatant suffering that is happening.
Does it give you any concern about how their experience would affect the United States?
Well, I mean, we are all part of a world community. And to the extent that any of us as human beings who have any level of compassion see suffering anywhere around the world, it impacts all of us. It impacts us all.
Could I answer that briefly? This president and vice president have re-engaged with the world already. Paris Climate Accords, re-entry into the World Health Organization. We all know that the World Health Organization, with the U.S. as the leader, eradicated smallpox, essentially with public health, eradicated polio, kept Ebola virus from spreading here and elsewhere. So we know they are committed to reversing the policy of the last 4 years to disengage from the world, and that will only mean more good news for a terribly suffering country of India now.
We'll take one more question.
Madam
I am willing to bet you that when the people of Cincinnati get on those buses being driven by Troy Miller's members, they do not ask, are you a Republican or a Democrat? I'm willing to bet you. When we are talking about those moms who need to walk on the sidewalk to get to the bus, pushing a stroller, walking a toddler, they are not identifying their problem through the lens of who they voted for in the last election. When we are looking at the capacity to grow the economic vitality of communities, including small businesses, and increase the productivity of a workforce, much less expand the workforce, what we know is that the reality is that people, regardless of who they vote for and which party they're registered with, that's what they want. And that's what they want to see their government focus on. Thank you. Extension of this conversation, frankly. I gave a speech yesterday talking about this. I was in, you will appreciate this, Chairman, I was with our former colleagues, Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire, visiting the New Hampshire Electric Co-op, and met with some workers there who were part of a legacy of folks at that co-op who helped build electrification for rural New Hampshire. And it was on the basis of the work, literally the physical basis of the work they did as a result of the 1936 Rural Electrification Act, which was about saying, let's get electricity to everybody, to say now, let's get broadband to everybody, because it's the same point. Kids can't do their homework without access to the internet. You know, some of us had Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, let me tell you, that is a day gone by. our seniors, we now know the capacity of access and affordable access to broadband to bring health care through telemedicine. Again, our small businesses. It has become very clear for a small business to actually survive, much less thrive, they need access to high-speed internet to be able to move their product, to advertise their product, and to engage with their customers. So it crosses all levels, all communities. And you know, in the past with electrification, I think it was one of the great examples of the role and responsibility of the federal government to meet the needs of the people where they are and to invest in America in a way that we will be competitive going forward. Broadband is the next example of that.
And do you see any bridges in this area qualifying for that top 10 list?
Well, I can tell you that I know about the Brent Spence Bridge, and it is a very important bridge in America, and I am sure that there will be a lot of conversation about its qualifications for some support out of the American Jobs Plan. Thank you.